The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
We see all the conspiracy theories and so on emanating out of human brains. What we don't want is for machines to replicate that kind of hallucination, which many of them currently do. So using generative AI systems as a kind of search engine is already proving very, very problematic. Where they're really useful is when you have a body of work you put into an AI system, like a set of laws that you want to analyze. You've got a closed system there and you basically want an answer.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Hearing. I'm your host, Becky Annison. All anyone is talking about in the law right now is AI, and we have another episode to help you get to grips with the risks and regulations in this area. My guest today is Lord Clement Jones, former chair of the House of Lords Artificial Intelligence Select Committee and co-chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Artificial Intelligence. He has written a book called Living with the Algorithm, which looks at the current approaches to AI regulation and governance, and he shared with me some of his insights and expansive knowledge on this subject.
The Hearing.
Hello, Tim. Thank you so much for coming to speak to me. I have got quite a lot of questions about AI and a lot of thoughts and feelings about AI, much of which are probably not based in fact. They're probably based in fear or bias or whatever. So I'm very excited to be able to talk to you about this. But I wanted to start the conversation, as all good lawyers do, by getting a really great definition of AI. So how do you define it, Tim?
Well, there are many different ways of doing it. And of course, it is there is the question as to how far you need to really define it. But for instance, there are the really dry versions. There's one by the International Organization for Standardization, ISO, which is very influential because it sets these international standards, which I'm so keen on. But it calls it an interdisciplinary field, usually regarded as a branch of computer science dealing with models and systems for the performance of functions generally associated with human intelligence, such as reasoning and learning. Now, that's okay. There's also the OECD definition, which is relatively new because they revised it last November. And this is the one that says it's a machine-based system that for explicit or implicit objectives infers from the input it receives how to generate outputs such as predictions, content, recommendations, or decisions that can influence physical or virtual environments. Different AI systems vary in their levels of autonomy and adaptiveness after deployment. I mean, what they've tried to do, and the EU follows that in their AI Act, in fact, they've tried to cover the bases, which covers generative AI and so on. Now, I much prefer, and I put this in my book as well, that a much simpler definition, which Brad Smith and Carol Ann Brown. And Brad's the president of Microsoft. So if he doesn't know what he's talking about, I don't know who does. But he, in Tools and Weapons, the book that he wrote with Carol Ann Brown, he talks about software that learns from experience. And I rather like that because it gives that circularity and also it gives a sense of autonomy, which, of course, increasingly is the case with these large language models, which learn as they go along. It's not just learning from testing, but it's learning from operation as well. I think if you want to keep a definition in your head, and I've only got a certain amount of room in my head, even though I used to be a lawyer, I still think that something simple works.
Interesting. I think what's particularly interesting to me is that I think our common conception up until quite recently of AI was probably informed very heavily by science fiction. So I'm thinking of the HAL computer from 2001, A Space Odyssey, or Data from Star Trek. And those operated at a much higher level of cognition than the definitions you've given, which is very interesting.
Yes, the narrative around AI has been sort of quite polarized. And it's something that when we did our House of Lords AI Select Committee a few years back, we were absolutely cognizant of, and it's very unhelpful in many ways, but it's understandable because after all the Greeks were talking about these kinds of machines, you know, talos went round Crete. We had Midas, who was able to turn things to gold and accidentally turned his daughter into gold. And then, of course, we've got all the folklore about golems in Prague through medieval times. We've had Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, you know. So this alien intelligence aspect is something that's very deeply ingrained in our thoughts. So, you know, we do have to be careful not to get too caught up in the narrative. But on the other hand, it's not unhelpful when we're talking about the risks.
Oh, well, that is very interesting to me. Okay, I'm going to ask you now what you think the major risks posed by AI are. And if you could weave that in, I'd be incredibly interested. I know that people talk about AI being an existential risk to humanity, not just in the narrative of stories, but also there was a letter, a very famous letter that was signed, is it, about a year ago by some leaders in the field that talked about this. How far do you think that's true? Where is the risk going to manifest?
Yes, and those signatories, they call for a moratorium, which I thought that wasn't particularly sensible. I mean, I use it sometimes talking about existential risk, but only really in connection with artificial general intelligence, which has not yet arrived. And artificial general intelligence is even more difficult to define than ordinary intelligence. It's not general AI, because general AI is here and now with these large language models and increasingly what are called multimodal models, which can do images, they can write, it can, you know, speak and so on and so forth. So what we've got to only, I think, talk about existential risk in connection with it is artificial general intelligence, which effectively is the replacement of humans. And, you know, some people say as soon as AGI arrives, well, that's the end of humanity. Now, that's a bit extreme, but, you know, a number of writers have said that. And people are very concerned that if a machine which is as intelligent as a human and as capable as a human takes over, then, you know, do human beings have a role anymore if they're, for instance, as creative as humans? Now, we're not there. And in the meantime, the reliability of AI systems is not that high when push comes to shove. So, for instance, they have hallucinations, they produce misinformation and disinformation. They amplify some of the wrong things. We get over-reliant on them, for instance. And so there are quite a number of risks. But in the meantime, of course, as well, we're using artificial intelligence systems which replace human beings. Sometimes they substitute completely, and sometimes they usefully augment what we have to do. So again, we have to pick our way through all that and make sure that AI is for our benefit and not for our detriment. And therefore, that leads on to, you know, regulation and so on, and ethical embedding in design, you know, all those aspects that we need to make sure that we get right, even before the advent of AGI. And, you know, one thing in particular that it concerns me is this over-reliance. Already you can see that, you know, lawyers themselves are using quite a bit of artificial intelligence in terms of tools that look at the language in emails. They summarize, they precede law, you know, all kinds of things. Now, you know, for instance, if we lose the art of being able to summarize, to precede things, we lose the art of being able to make a speech because, for instance, we just get artificial intelligence systems to do it for us. Well, you know, this is a bit like losing the ability to walk or use our hands in these circumstances. So again, we have to be conscious of what is happening.
What do you think are the really good uses of AI then, and particularly for lawyers, but I think also more generally? I think the reason that I say that is that having watched the advent of AI over the last few years in particular, one of the most obvious ways that I've seen it manifest is in generative AI around images and around writing. You now see books being written completely by AI with a picture on the front cover generated by AI popping up on Amazon for sale, many of which have holes in them. One of the strangest things I find about this is I want AI to do the things I find boring. I don't want AI to take away my ability to do art. I'm a big believer. There's a beautiful quote by, I think, Kurt Vonnegut, the writer, who says, art isn't a way of making a living. It's a way of making a life. But what should we be using AI for, do you think?
Well, what we shouldn't be using AI for is simply ingesting every known book and work of art and using that to test and train generative AI systems. I mean, this is very controversial at the moment, and the whole IP discussion is moving very, very slowly, unfortunately. And I think the creative industries are finding it difficult getting their voice heard in these circumstances. You know, it's all about, oh, shouldn't we have a text and data mining exception for these lovely AI systems to be able to use to train and all that. But people are very worried about that. And the fact that you can simply say to an AI system, oh, look, do me something in the style of Van Gogh. You know, now that's okay because Van Gogh's out of copyright, but a heck of a lot of works aren't. Authors, writers, musicians. So they've all got a common interest in making sure that when material is ingested into these generative AI systems, that licenses are properly taken and the copyright is paid for. Now, you know, that is by and large not been the case, and the horse has bolted in some respects. Which is, you know, it's move fast and break things. It's, you know, don't ask for permission, just apologize afterwards. Well, frankly, you know, that is not proper behavior. And that's another reason for making sure there's proper regulation. But the uses of AI, I mean, I'm an optimist. I do believe, I mean, maybe I'm just somebody with a legal background who believes in the force of law. But I do believe that it is possible to regulate and incorporate ethics into regulation. And I do believe, therefore, that it's that the use of AI is something that society can benefit from. In things like healthcare, discovery of new molecules, of new treatments for cancer, for instance, the ability to diagnose with imaging, the ability actually to advise doctors generally on, you know, quite a large scale on the kinds of treatments that might be appropriate. You know, multimodal models are increasingly coming on stream in the medical area and the health area. So I think that's very important. I think there are ways of solving some of the sustainable development goals. I mean, for instance, in agriculture, the ability to map terrain and discover patterns of climate and the right kind of conditions in which you can grow more sustainable crops, which will be a higher yield, for instance. You can do that through AI in ways that were not possible before. So, you know, I could adumbrate a number of different areas where I would get quite excited about the use of AI. But of course, in interpersonal relationships, social media, elections, you know, with deep fakes and so on and so forth, those risks are there. And therefore, you know, the great tech bro enthusiasts for AI need checking. And, you know, we mustn't get carried away by this. It's quite possible for people like me to want regulation, but at the same time, be enthusiastic about new technology.
Absolutely. In fact, as you're saying that, it's starting to kind of spark ideas off in my own head around the real good use of AI isn't to do the jobs that I, Becky, find boring, much as I might wish it were, but it's really to advance human thinking in fields where we as humans are not capable of processing all of the data that is out there and exists in our brains because they are finite. A computer doesn't have the same finite limitations, that it can absorb more data more quickly and churn out solutions, which humans could never do on their own because our brains are limited.
that you're absolutely right. And it's funny, I was just reading a rather good book, and I tend to read far too many books on AI, but I was reading a book that takes the whole aspect of how to improve human memory back to Bruno Giordano back in the Middle Ages, and who was actually sadly burnt at the stake in Rome for heretical thoughts. But what he was all about was building this kind of memory that would help humans solve some of their issues. And that's exactly where AI can come in all of this, because they can they have a memory bank far, far greater than any human being. And that's what we must tap into. But what we've got to make sure that memory bank is accurate. It's no point. I mean, humans are hallucinate enough as it is. Nobody ever said human beings were perfect. We see all the conspiracy theories and so on emanating out of human brains. But what we don't want is for machines to replicate that kind of hallucination, which many of them currently do. So using AI system, generative AI systems, as a kind of search engine is already proving very, very problematic. And how we resolve that is quite tricky. You know, where they're really useful is when you have a body of work you put into an AI system, like a set of laws that you want to analyze. You've got a closed system there and you basically want an answer. Now, that's fine. But it's when you introduce all sorts of unspecified data and so on, and you don't know where it's come from and you don't know what its provenance is and so on and so forth, that is when I think it gets very tricky. And, we've got to avoid this kind of hallucination. And also, sometimes it isn't just accidental. It's, definitely deliberate. So, deep fakes. There was a fake of the one of the candidates in the Czech presidential election quite recently, which, could and probably did influence the election. So, we're getting to the point where we're going to have to get quite worried about the general election. Countries with populations of 4 billion are having elections this year, including India and the States and so on, and the UK the EU. So we've got to be very advertent to the ability of these systems to deliver misinformation, deep fakery, and so on.
Goodness. Well, and then let's move straight on to what do we need to see from lawmakers? Because that's deeply worrying.
It is deeply worrying. And the trouble is that different jurisdictions are doing different things. Now, I can come to how we resolve those differences. But in the first instance, I think even though eventually the EU may have to have a reflection, as they call it, on the current AI Act, it's an interesting and good start, basically. A lot of people got excited about the fact that it was over-regulation and so on. But actually, it's a risk-based form of regulation. They've said certain risks are unacceptable, manipulative type use of AI and so on. Certain forms of live facial recognition, which aren't for national security or policing, are unacceptable. And, a number of unacceptable risks which are excluded. But by and large, this is risk-based. You have to carry out a conformity assessment, risk-based assessment of what its impact is going to be. And certain consequences follow depending on the level of risk. Now, that seems to me to be an eminently sensible way of doing it. There will be a central authority which will have a certain degree of ability to regulate specifically a generative AI system. They've added in provisions about generative AI, quite late on in the process. But it to me, that demonstrated the flexibility of the rulemaking system in Brussels, and the fact that then the Parliament, the Commission, and the Council of Ministers, managed to come to an agreement at the end of last year, I think was all to the good, and it's now had the approval of the Parliament in its final form. So I think it's a good way forward, and they're hoping it's going to be the equivalent of the GDPR, and it may or may not be the case. I suspect that many of the big American companies are going to engage in litigation first before they accept that it's the gold standard like GDPR was treated by people like Microsoft as. You know, we already see people like Apple complaining about the way the Digital Services Act operates, and I suspect that and the Digital Markets Act. So I suspect that they'll also litigate on things like people like OpenAI will litigate on the AI Act. But the UK, and I can go into that in more detail, in their white paper and their response to the consultation on the white paper, has been far more laissez-faire, and they seem to think that if the regulator exhorts the companies that they regulate, like Ofcom, like the FCA, and so on, that that will be enough. But then not every sector is regulated, and most people don't respond unless they have a legal duty to do so. You know, corporate governance is all very fine, and I would urge certainly in-house lawyers to start thinking about these things before any regulation comes into play. But for the UK just to have this sort of what they call pro-innovation, context-specific form of governance, which isn't governance at all, you know, they've had lots of lovely things like setting up an AI Safety Institute, the Bletchley Declaration, and so on and so forth. But none of it adds up to a row of beans unless there is some compulsion, some mandation of ethical standards at the very least. Even the states, with their executive order from the White House and their blueprint for technology, has been actually more muscular, and bills introduced in Congress could well, because they're bipartisan, could well happen before too long. So, you know, I get the sense that the UK is falling behind, except in one respect, which is the agreement on international standards, where I think that's quite hopeful. And I can go into that a bit more if you'd like me to.
I absolutely would. Although I just wanted to say, I think you're absolutely right about the hill of beans. My experience from many years as an in-house lawyer is that you do what is regulated, you do what has a fine attached to it, you do what has a potential jail term for a director attached to it, but to do anything else, to go beyond and do something voluntarily, means cutting into your profit margin, and the shareholders will start to complain about that pretty quickly, or meaning you're less competitive and some will complain about that pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there is a way through this, because the worst thing, and this is the problem with things like changing our data protection legislation here in comparison with the EU, that the worst thing is if you're a major company, or you're a sort of middling company but you want to do business abroad and so on, or if you're a developer and you want your product to be available outside the UK, in the States, for instance, or Europe, you need some assurance that what you're doing isn't going to fall foul of the regulation that they're putting into effect. You know, even if the UK is frightfully laissez-faire, you want to basically adhere to, know you're adhering to a set of common standards. So I'm a great believer, irrespective of what the UK does, in making sure that we know what those international standards are and we try and get convergence on them, so we get that kind of interoperability. Now, there's a lot of work happening there with people like ISO, with people like IEEE, the electrical engineers, with people like the National Institute for Standards and Technology in the States, and the European standard setting body, CENELEC. So, and the kind of standards we're talking about are risk assessment, testing, audit, continuous monitoring. And if we get that right, and the OECD is doing a lot of work in trying to find the common elements and converging those standards into commonly accepted standard, we're not there by any manner of means, but there is progress being made. And if we could get to that point, then in a sense, companies would say to themselves, great, look, even though the UK is not legislating for this, we're still going to adhere to these standards. And any in-house lawyer would say to themselves, well, look, that's a very sensible thing to do. So that helps us get through the hoops in Europe. It helps us get through the hoops in the US. And, you know, quite frankly, it means that our developers have the confidence to move forward. Plus, the public will trust what we're doing, because let's face it, as the consumer gets more and more savvy about the uses of AI, they're going to want that kind of assurance, and trust is absolutely crucial. So I think public trust and business confidence and certainty go together, and that's why agreeing on these standards is so important.
That sounds like a really good way through quite a maze-like situation at the moment.
The Hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool, but inside there's a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day, in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
I wanted to turn the discussion back to intellectual property, which you mentioned earlier, which I find very, very interesting in this area. And I've seen quite a lot of discussions, potential curbs on AI sort of coming through the back door out of copyright cases, especially in the US. I know that there is a case, there's probably more than one case ongoing in the United States, where creators and authors are suing various generative AIs for using their materials without permission. But I've also seen another case in the US, which I thought was very interesting, which said, and I'm sure this will get overturned in a heartbeat, but it said that the product of generative AI was not possible to be copyrighted. I thought that was very interesting. So you've used it to create a book, which you've put on Amazon with a nice AI generated cover. Well, you have no copyright in that now. I thought that nothing will turn Disney off AI faster than the idea that the next Mickey Mouse is not subject to AI, subject to intellectual property protections. But I just wondered what your kind of view on those kind of trends in intellectual property were, and where you think they're going to end up.
Yes, it's a fascinating situation. And in addition to the writers and musicians and so on, we've got Getty, we've got New York Times. They're all queuing up to sue, basically. Now, the big tech companies are saying, oh, no, it's all subject to fair dealing. You know, this is fair dealing when we ingest all this material. Well, I don't think that's the case, but we'll see what they say in the States. You know, it'll go all the way to the Supreme Court, probably. Over here and in Europe, we have a rather different situation. Certainly over here, things created by a computer have quite a decent history of getting copyright protection, provided they've got a reasonable degree of originality. So that means that actually material which is produced by AI systems has a very good chance of copyright protection. As far as ingestion is concerned, there's a pretty good reason to think that all that material is covered by copyright. And certainly that's been my position. It's been the position of the music industry and so on and so forth. And basically, you know, we've all believed that the companies needed licenses. Now, the IPO, the Intellectual Property Office, I think has not been very muscular about this at all. You wonder who the hell they're protecting, basically. But and they needed, my view, to make a much more robust statement about this, and they try to get a voluntary agreement between big tech and the copyright owners and so on, the rights holders, but failed, and they admitted they'd failed, and they've said it's now gone to the DCMS and DCIT to broker an agreement, basically, between the two departments. Well, I find that utterly incredible. They need a lead, and they need basically telling that there needs to be a proper licensing arrangement, There is no text and data mining exemption that covers that. It is copyrighted, and therefore, if you ingest this material, you need to pay for it. Now, what I'm very keen on, in addition to all that, is a very high degree of transparency. See, one of the problems at the moment, and it applies to both data and content, is that there is no obligation on an AI developer when they create a large language model or other form of generative AI system, is to say what material has been ingested for training purposes or testing or operation or whatever. And what we need is the transparency that says, yep, this is the full set that we've ingested. And interestingly enough, that's what the EU are expecting, are insisting on as part of the AI Act. The downside in the EU is that they do have a text and data mining exemption for this kind of material, but you can opt out of it. Now, I think that's fine for the Reed Elseviers, for the RELEXes of this world, because they know exactly how the system works. But for the SME, the average SME or a single author or whatever, I mean, they won't have a clue about opting out and stuff like that. So I'm not a big fan of what the EU have actually done as regards intellectual property, except this transparency obligation, which is very powerful.
Gosh, I've got so many thoughts and questions spilling out of what you've just said. The first of which, I suppose, is a rather pointy question, I suppose. Do you think the people creating the large language models even know what their data set is at this point?
No, I doubt very much whether they do. That's what I meant by the horse being having bolted.
Ah, yes.
But of course, the good thing is they may have to start all over again, because in terms of creating some of their systems, because of the hallucination problem. Now, I'm not a techie myself, so they will have to say, how do we get rid of hallucinations? Well, it may be starting from scratch. You know, I mean, they're incredibly powerful, these machines, and I find them very useful when I want to develop thoughts about things. You know, tell me what sort of considerations I should have when I'm considering so-and-so. You know, it's quite useful like that as a kind of creative tool. But if you, as I said earlier, if you treat it like a search engine, it comes up with the wrong answers. And of course, it can, with these prompt injection attacks, actually deliberately get round some of the guardrails. Again, may need reconstructing. So you can, if you get it right, you can ask it how to make a bomb by asking a question in a particular way. Now, that's pretty worrying too. And then again, you build on that with open source. With open source, like Llama, which is Meta's AI system, you know, you've got a very powerful tool there, which can be altered by somebody because they know what the source code is. So, you know, there's quite a lot of risk involved in just the construction of these systems. So we may need to go back and say, right, we need, before we get this out any further, we may have to rebuild everything from scratch. Question mark, is that going to happen?
Well, I suppose that leads me on to thinking, I suppose I have two further questions, the first of which relating to the intellectual property point again, because I do find it so interesting. If you take a company like Meta, and I'm not saying this is what Meta have done, I'm just using them as a stand-in here, who have trained their AI on a data set which includes copyrighted works that in other circumstances you would require a license for. One of the thoughts that I've been having, and I'm curious to float this past you, is, are we in a situation where they have used so much data so indiscriminately that if they were charged a license fee, it could almost break the company, because the cost of paying that license fee to so many people would be prohibitive?
I think the companies involved are massive. I mean, when you look at the sort of $10 billion invested in OpenAI by Microsoft now and OpenAI are more or less you know, one company in many respects. You've got Meta, hugely powerful company. You've got Apple, hugely powerful. Amazon, they are the top of the leaderboard on the New York Stock Exchange, for heaven's sake. They're the most valuable companies on the planet. So they are the chief transgressors when they're putting together these AI systems. I mean, there are some sort of startups out there. I think Stability AI is probably one of them. But, you know, by and large, the real transgressors are the biggest companies. So, no, I'm not too worried about that. I think one of the really important aspects of AI is where do the fruits of the rewards of AI go? That's one of the key things we have to decide for the future. So this is an important aspect and one we need to resolve.
That's a really good point you make. If the AI itself is built on hundreds of years of human creative thought, well, who gets the benefit of that? Should it be a handful of tiny companies, or should it be the whole of humanity who has contributed to making it possible?
Yeah, and of course that brings one on to the whole question of antitrust and competition law and so on and so forth. I mean, one of the things that really worries me is we're jumping into the same situation as we are in cloud. You know, only three main cloud providers. We're in the same area as social media, a very few major social media providers. You name it, two platforms, Google and Apple, and a little bit of Microsoft. But, you know, quite frankly, these are major issues in terms of, do we allow these big companies to dominate our lives forever? You know, and AI is going down exactly the same track. And if that is the case, then we have to make sure that there is pretty decent regulation, which makes sure that they behave themselves.
Yes. I'm just thinking back in my own career a few years ago, you know, 10, 20 years ago, social media was, you know, if you had something go wrong on social media, you could just step away and not use it. Whereas now our working lives are so inextricably intertwined with social media. It has a real impact on our jobs for the most part. Our careers, that there is no, oh, well, I'll just choose not to use it. I'll just step away. It's not really possible to do that anymore.
No, absolutely. And you have to have the connectivity. You have to be, and you're going to be using a lot of this technology, and business doesn't have much choice as to what it uses, you know. So the historic behavior of the big players has been to snap up smaller businesses as they go along. Anything that shows any sort of signs of innovation, like sort of Instagram or whatever, is snapped up. Google buys YouTube. I mean, the whole thing is that's what you do. And there's been no restraint really on their ability to do that, because it's being seen as a sort of separate market. Well, of course, they're not really separate markets at all.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm going to move us on. I suppose you might have already answered this question, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to add anything, I think. Is there any jurisdictions at all out there which you think are really forward-thinking on AI, doing things, you know, at a really interesting forward-thinking level, even beyond where the EU is at? Or if there is not a jurisdiction, what would you see should be in the gold standard of AI regulation, which is not currently there?
I think that the EU hasn't got it right on intellectual property, but I think for most other things, it is getting it right. But of course, it doesn't come into effect until 2026. And the big issue for me is what kind of standards are underpinning the AI Act are going to be insisted on. And I don't think we know quite yet. If the EU, you know, plays it very insular, then in a very insular way, then I think that's going to be a problem for a lot of people. What I hope they will do is collaborate and cooperate on international standards. So people will find that actually, if they conform to those standards, they're conforming to the AI Act, if they're in the high risk or medium risk area. So we don't know yet. But, you know, for my money, I would pursue the standards. And I think there's good practice in a lot of places. I mean, the Alan Turing, for instance, with its standards hub, AI standards hub, is doing good work. And I'm a big fan of the HEI. The National Institute for Standards and Technology in the States, they are, you know, very, very well thought of in terms of what they're doing. And then again, of course, what we haven't talked about is AI in the public sector. And, you know, the Canadians are doing good stuff in AI in the public sector. You know, there's a register of AI systems in use. There's an impact assessment that has to be carried out, which I think is a really important aspect. And nobody at the moment is predicating that there's a workplace impact assessment for AI systems. Mm. And that is something which has been put forward by the Institute for the Future of Work. I think that is the future in the workplace too, because I don't want to be surveilled by an AI system that assesses my performance without me knowing exactly what the parameters are. And probably I wouldn't want it to be in place in any event. So, you know, although there's some good practice, I think we're still in the foothills, and there are still things that I will keep campaigning on. Mm. For instance, autonomous weapons. We haven't got an agreement yet. Between the major nations. We haven't even got an agreement that we're not going to combine nuclear weapons with artificial intelligence, for instance, which is absolutely crucial. You know, the UN has passed a resolution on the subject, but, you know, the scariest thing of all is AI controlling a nuclear weapon.
Choosing targets and that sort of thing.
And if we haven't agreed on that, well, you know, we may not see the fruits of our labours in the future.
And going back to the existential crisis for humanity there, aren't we?
Yeah, big time. Yeah.
It's moving away from the end of humanity. I was very interested in what you said about AI in the workplace, actually, and thinking, is this a space where the unions need to be looking at it and protecting the workers? But I was also thinking, I suspect that lots of people are touching AI in their day jobs without even realizing that that's what they're doing, and using things like, I think Grammarly is based on AI, isn't it? And similar tools that we're using all the time now that people just don't realize are AI. Having a register of that seems like a very sensible idea.
No, it's really important that. Actually, the TUC has done some pretty good work on this.
Ah.
They produced some good reports on AI in the workplace. But you're right. I mean, if you look at you know, what's happening in warehouses, Amazon's warehouses, they're using AI for performance management. Well, you know, how transparent is that, for heaven's sake? And, you know, I know people like Foxglove have campaigned quite heavily on those sorts of issues about whether, you know, it's right that Amazon should be using those kinds of tools. So, yeah, I mean, we need to bring all this out in the open and have a debate.
Very interesting. I'm going to close out with my final question now, if that's okay. If there was one thing you would like the ordinary lawyer to know about AI, either personally or professionally, what would that be?
Ah, good question. I think that the ordinary lawyer, whether they're in-house or advising their client, should be aware that at the end of the day, this kind of new technology is the responsibility of the senior people in the company. This is not something that you just leave to the chief technology officer or the chief information officer, because the implications of AI are, you know, very big. They're ethical as well as legal. Now, lawyers aren't always comfortable with ethics, but the fact is that what we're trying to do is combine ethical duties into a sort of regulatory system. And that's what the EU tried to do, bringing in the OECD principles. It's what the government pay lip service to over here. So at the end of the day, big boards are going to be judged by how they use AI and the guardrails they put around AI if there aren't regulatory guardrails. So I do think that's important. And I think that if you need any reminder of the difficulty of technology sometimes, just look at the post office and Horizon. You know, that's not a happy situation. Senior management may or may not have known about the frailties of that particular form of technology. Well, AI is far, far more significant even than something like Horizon, because it has a greater degree of autonomy. So I would say that people need to think quite carefully.
That's a fantastic point to end on, Tim. Thank you so much for coming and speaking to me. I really feel that I get to indulge all of my curious questions when I get to speak to people like you, and I'm so very grateful. Thank
Pleasure.
You very much.
No, been great. Thanks very much, Becky.
The Hearing.
As Tim and many others have no doubt observed, the horse has most definitely bolted. AI exists, and multiple companies are in an expensive race to create different AIs. Many people are already using AI in their day-to-day work, either knowingly or unknowingly. But I found the most interesting part of the discussion was less the regulation, but the governance, and specifically what this means for corporate governance. Now, I know that most boards in most companies need to have an ever-increasing and quite dizzying array of skills and knowledge available to them, and I hesitate to suggest that this should be expanded even further. But if companies are going to use AI, they will need to truly understand what that means and what the risks are. Hearing Tim drawing a direct line between the use of AI by corporates and the potential for another scandal like Royal Mail and Horizon in the UK shows us some of what could go wrong. And, at least for the moment, we don't have a regulatory regime in place that guides us safely through those risks. It will be down to the board's knowledge. I've been your host, Becky Annison. A huge thank you to Lord Clement Jones for speaking to me, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do like and subscribe, or send us an email at thehearing@thomsonreuters.com. Goodbye.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.